Welcome to Rooster Radio, where we talk to interesting people doing amazing things. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. This is yet another episode where James and I ask dumb questions of smart people. In fact, maybe that should be the tagline of our show. We tackle the topic of quantum computing with Michael Brett, CEO of QX Branch, a company based in Adelaide and the US, developing tools and applications powered by quantum computing. Michael says quantum computing is the biggest change in computing since computing, and it's set to change the world. It's being embraced by aerospace, defence and finance industries, particularly when it comes to complex data problems, and will impact our everyday lives. Michael explains how this will happen, the real-world benefits and the global effort required to bring quantum computing to the fore. Enjoy our chat with Michael Brett.
Michael, welcome to Rooster Radio.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, quantum computing. How does it already impact our lives?
It's a really interesting time for quantum computing because we're seeing it transition from universities and research labs and like government-funded R&D to what is now commercial R&D, so the commercialization of this technology. It's still very early, so we're not yet in the position where people are using quantum computers operationally, but the very early stage pieces of hardware are available and some of the technology ecosystem is starting to form. And so what we're doing is building the tools and the applications that will sit on top of quantum computing hardware.
It seems like a very new kind of discipline and technology. How do you explain it to myself and Andrew, who do not have a degree in quantum computing
or a degree at all?
Well, yeah, we try not to broadcast that. Try not to broadcast that too loudly, Monty. But
it's definitely tough to explain it. And in fact, Microsoft made some announcements this morning about their initiatives in quantum computing. And there was a quote in the Wall Street Journal from Bill Gates saying that it is the one technology at Microsoft that even he cannot explain. So, you know, it stumps the best of us. But quantum computing is a fundamentally different type of computer. So it's not just a matter of going faster. It's not just putting a faster engine in the car. It's building an entirely different way of doing computational work. And the key difference to understand is that as we've got smaller and smaller with computer chips and transistors, the building blocks of a regular computer have become tinier and tinier, we've got almost to the fundamental limit of how small we can make something. And so the next step is to go inside the atom to the quantum level and start to use the weird behavior that exists at that part of the universe to do computational work.
So I did hear somewhere that the idea of, I can't remember this, every 18 months, you know, the speed of a computer doubles. But that we're hitting that limit now, that the current sort of technology actually will limit us, won't let us go forward. This is seen as kind of the next wave.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So when I was a kid, every 18 months or so, you'd see like the 286, the 386, the 486 coming out, and you could feel this like doubling of power in your PC at home. And more recently, like as we've read Moore's Law over the past 50 years of that doubling of computing power every 18 months, more recently, however, we've reached that fundamental limit of how small we can make a transistor. And so that's why we're starting to see different architectures come into computers today. So your laptop, your phone has now like multi-threaded, multi-core, multi-chip systems to try and keep up with the power because we just couldn't cram more transistors onto the same size chip. And so that's why quantum computing is so interesting, is that it's a fundamentally different type of computer. We go to the next level of scale inside the atom and to start to use some of the weird behaviors of quantum mechanics.
So what are how do you articulate the real world practical benefits?
Sure. So the real power of quantum computing is that it's a probabilistic machine. So it works on probabilities to do work. And so a classical computer will compute to a very high precision, but it might take quite some time to get to that answer. What a quantum computer can do is calculate an approximate answer very, very quickly. And so that's got a lot of practical applications in things like machine learning, training autonomous vehicles, developing systems like drones, because we don't need precision so much for developing these algorithms to support autonomous cars, but we need answers very quickly to that. So if you're close enough quickly, that's a great response from a computer rather than being precise in a very long period of time.
Hang on, this still blows my mind. How do you get the sort of sub structures of an atom to work for you to then assist with computations?
This blows my mind as well every day. The understanding of quantum science, so the behavior of the very, very small, that has gone in leaps and bounds over the last 30 years or so. And one of the most interesting parts of that for us is quantum information science. So understanding how to write information to and read information from devices that work in that domain. And it's phenomenal to all of us that we can, as kind of humans with our ingenuity, control something at that scale and to get computational work from it. There's an incredible amount of science that's been done and an incredible amount of science yet to be done in that space to truly understand it. But now we've got an engineering challenge ahead of us as well to build machines that work with this stuff.
So I would imagine that, I guess, historically in the last couple of decades, all this work is being done in labs. How is it now emerging into the mainstream or the commercial world?
Yeah, so the way we see the future of quantum computing is in the cloud. So the likes of Google, IBM, Microsoft, Amazon Web Services, all of those companies have made quantum computing investments over the last few years. And the way that this will manifest is that in the cloud, you know, massively computationally intensive environment, you'll have multiple different architectures of computers. So you'll have CPUs, which we've used forever, GPUs, graphical processing units, like what we use for computer games, but more recently for machine learning and AI work, then other architectures for doing more advanced versions of AI, and then quantum computers sit alongside that. And so the cloud environment will have multiple different types of computer, and the right algorithm will be allocated to the right hardware to do that work. So I'm not making a prediction there'll be a quantum computer on every desktop because they'll be in that cloud environment, but you'll be able to access a quantum computer from every desktop. So your phone, your car, your Internet of Things devices at home, they'll be pinging quantum computing technology in the cloud to quickly do a computation and get the answer back to you. And so that's how we'll interact with it.
So we're moving. We're not quite there yet in terms of hard and fast practical applications yet, but it's not that far away.
Yeah, that's right. So there's no operational commercial use of quantum computing that I'm aware of today, because essentially what we have is the prototype devices, the sort of alpha device, the beta device, the early stage version of them that companies like ours are starting to look at the applications with. But it's accelerating so quickly. The amount of investment going into this field, the kind of work that's being done, we expect to see quantum computing accessible in the cloud in the next couple of years.
So how do you create then a business in a world where actually there's no practical application yet? What are the business fundamentals?
Yeah, so our company, QBranch, we're a data analytics company. So what we focus on is finding extremely challenging data analytics problems, so things like machine learning and AI, and working in finance and insurance and with other technology companies. And so we solve those problems today using the best available classical technique, but we're also investing in quantum computing because we see that as a long-term technology differentiator for what we do, and the biggest impact of quantum computing will be on data analytics. So we've got customers in our classical part of the business, but also customers in our quantum part of the business that are working with us to identify those particular applications and start to get ahead of the development curve. And the idea is that on day one that the quantum computers are available, we want apps in the app store ready to go that people can download and start to use straight away.
Can you give us some examples of the types of problems that your clients are coming to you with?
So we're doing some work with the Commonwealth Bank of Australia. CBA have been investing in quantum computing for quite some time now, probably about 5 years, initially investing in the research parts of the program. Just in the past couple of weeks, they helped fund a quantum computing hardware company based here in Australia to commercialize quantum computing hardware tech. And we've been working with CBA to look at the applications that are enabled by that. And so what we've built with them is a development environment that their engineers, their software developers, their data scientists can use internal to the bank with their own data, their own systems, and start to explore the applications of this. The type of things that we're interested in are principally optimization problems, so things like portfolio optimization. So looking at all of our superannuation accounts, how do we optimize that portfolio to get the best possible return? And that's a very computationally intensive problem. There's a lot of work that's required to find the optimal allocation of stocks for each of our particular needs. And so with a new type of computer, we can do that much more efficiently.
It seems like a perfect intersection of research, sort of commercial realities, you know, universities and sort of local business. It seems like you're in that hinge between it all at the moment.
That's exactly where we love to play. It's such an interesting field right now that we need basic and applied research coming from the universities. We need relationships with the likes of Microsoft, Google, IBM, and Amazon because they'll be the ones providing the infrastructure. We need relationships with corporates that will be the end users of what we build. And so QBranch is that we try to position to be right in the middle of all of that field because it's so exciting and we see an enormous amount of opportunity there.
You mentioned finance. There's obviously other industries that this is just made for, space being one of them. You're in town at the moment for, what is it, the world's biggest space conference?
That's in Adelaide.
Here in Adelaide. 4,000 space professionals, I think, Premier Joe
Weatherill. We are a bit of a space hub, aren't we, of the world, Adelaide?
There's a few space cadets, that's for sure. What are kind of the possibilities in the space industry and in your world?
Yeah. So this is an incredibly exciting week for Adelaide. This is the world's biggest space conference, and it is the highest attended version of this space conference in the entire history of this program. So it's the International Astronautical Congress. I've been coming to this series for about 10 years now, and it's an incredibly just great gathering of folks in Adelaide. They announced a space agency for Australia on Monday to help accelerate the industry here. What's so interesting about the space industry right now is that it's changing from being a very nation state driven industry where you've got, you know, space stations and space shuttles and countries doing work to a very commercially driven and focused enterprise. Because one of the things that we can access from space is a lot of data, particularly like Earth observation data, so maps. Think of Google Maps and the kind of resolution that's required to support self-driving cars and all sorts of applications. Communication systems, geoinformatics, and precision navigation and timing. So there's an enormous demand to support the things that we're doing here on Earth with data from space. And so what's really exciting for a data analytics company is that we've got this absolute treasure trove of data that's being produced from space assets, so satellites, that's coming down that needs to be analyzed. We need to detect patterns, detect changes, find the signals in all of that data that we can then create value here on Earth.
What are some really specific examples of how our lives currently would be guided by this process, you know, this
sure.
stuff.
I'll give you two examples. The first one in precision navigation and timing. So think of GPS and the way that we use GPS today. If we're able to improve the resolution of GPS, so get it from 20 meters accuracy down to 2 meters accuracy or 20 centimeters accuracy, that improves the way that we can operate things like self-driving cars. So with higher precision autonomous vehicles, that changes the way that we think about the design of cities and the way that that will work together. A friend of mine was just telling me this morning about an application they're looking at there where if we can detect to a high enough precision the change in displacement of a ship. So a ship in port, you're loading containers on there, and you can see how the ship would sink into the water. You could tell just from space assets whether that container ship was loaded sufficiently and whether you could put more containers on there or more iron ore or whatever to get more value out of that shipping system.
You're going to have to explain how this occurs, and it might not be specifically your field, but how does this beam of information either, you know, get sent up and back down or just, you know, get transported? How does it happen?
Yeah, it's actually very similar to the way that our mobile phones work. So you have towers all around the city that are providing data systems and precision timing to our phones so that they work. Just take one of those towers off the tall office building and put it in space instead. And it's the same kind of technology infrastructure, but we're able to wrap that globally and to provide additional services based on that.
It feels like what you've kind of been telling us is that we're on the cusp of going to the next level in terms of quantum computing. What are the barriers or challenges that currently exist?
So in order to accelerate the commercialization of quantum computing, there's a couple of things that we need to get right. The first is to work with the folks that are developing the hardware. That's the most critical thing. And software companies and data analytics companies can dream of quantum computing as much as we like, but until we get access to the hardware, that's going to be a challenge. So we need to support them and to continue investing in quantum computing hardware companies like what we've seen in Australia in the past couple of weeks. The next challenge is our workforce. So how do we create a workforce that can explain quantum computing to their friends, to their parents, and say, I want to get involved in this technology, and to start to build up the skills that are necessary to either build new hardware devices, think of applications, create data analytics products based on quantum computing. And quantum computing is hard. It is an extremely technically challenging field. And so we need people in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and maths to come through high school, to go into university, and to learn these fields.
I was going to say, how do you invest in something that even Bill Gates doesn't really understand? Like when you go to CBA and you say, okay, well, you know, we recommend you guys invest in this stuff, and you know, they say, what's it all about? Well, look, just trust us.
You know, part of our job is to learn how to explain this and to show the opportunity of quantum computing, that it's very real. We can do it. The science is well understood. We're starting to see the effects of these prototype systems. We know this is going to happen. And what gives me a lot of faith is that particularly young people, they're very quick and eager to adopt new ideas and new technology. So as long as we put this in front of them and get it in their hands, I have no doubt that we've got the ingenuity to be able to create a lot of value from this technology.
Yeah, so how do you see the talent pool? Because you're in town for a hackathon, which I think involved the university and others. Is there kind of students lining up to get involved in this, or are you still selling it?
No, it's incredibly exciting field. So last Friday here in Adelaide, we ran a quantum computing hackathon. This was produced in partnership between QBranch, Defence SA, and the University of Adelaide. So at the University of Adelaide, we had about 55 participants from all over. So we had all three universities, defence, industry participants, and they came to this day to learn how to do practical quantum computing. So we gave them quantum computing 101 in the morning, taught them how to use taught them the concepts, and then provide them access to some of our tools so then they could start to build applications and to get a feel for how this technology will manifest. So we had people there that from second year undergraduate computer science all the way through to very senior industry folks learning for the first time how to use this new technology. There was a massive wait list. People wanted to come, and particularly the undergrads, they see the signals from the likes of IBM, Microsoft, and Amazon that this is the future of computing. This is the biggest change in computing since computing. And so if you're a young software engineer or computer scientist, to know that you can get involved at the ground floor of this technology and it'll be part of your career, people just want to line up and be a part of it.
One of the beautiful things about being at the front edge of a technology that isn't completely developed yet is there seems to be a real sense of collaboration. You know, it's not like you're all competing against each other to grab a slice of the pie. It's you're all actually working together to build the pie. How do you learn and keep abreast of the changes in your field?
This is truly an international, like global effort to create quantum computing and to get that into the marketplace. And so, yeah, there is like a little bit of friendly competition today, but for the most part, the entire field wants to succeed. And so none of us are going to fail because we got out-competed by the other at this point. It's because we need the entire field to lift. And so we put a lot of effort into attending conferences together, being collaborative, working on like open standards, open sourcing what software we can, really sharing a lot of ideas internationally so that we can get this technology into commercialization.
On a personal level, I'm interested in how you approach problems as a concept, not from a you know, a quantum computing perspective, but even on a personal level, as someone who is a specialist in problem solving, I mean, I think, what's your qualification? It's complex projects. So this is your world. How do you approach a problem when it arises or when it's given to you by a client? What's your early steps that you take?
Just for the listeners, he's smirking. So I don't know what he's thinking.
It's a tough question because, you know, practically, it's a lot of time on the whiteboard just working with very smart people around me that can help me understand this stuff.
Well, what are the questions you might first ask that person who has brought a problem to you?
So it always starts with a need somehow. What is the driving need of that person, whether it's to reduce costs or to increase revenue or to create some new capability out of that? And so when I refer to the whiteboard work, that is very much an explorative activity where just trying to understand what that person really needs in their life that's going to change them. Often they'll come with a preconceived notion about what they want, but that might not be what they need. And so really spending a lot of time understanding the human side of that. What are you trying to accomplish out of this? And then not trying to hit every problem with the same hammer of technology, but creating a what we call the capability elements. So technology is just one piece. You've then got people, processes, tools, governance, culture, all of that surrounds a problem or surrounds a capability that then makes that useful in the real world.
Fascinating that you talk about the human element as being incredibly important, and yet a big focus is data and it's the technology side, and yet the intersection of those is so critical, isn't it? How people use this stuff, why they use it, even, you know, how they input data, how they, you know, live and breathe it.
Yeah, I certainly think that, you know, we're here on this planet, we're here to improve the human existence in some way and to improve the life around us in different ways. And so technology is one enabler of that. But it's really a human condition that we're trying to support and to improve all of our lives in some way.
As you kind of pioneer in this space, who are the people that inspire you? Who are the other leaders, and what is it about them that are kind of helping them forge in this area?
So I draw a lot of strength out of the folks that are the starting companies and working to generate their own businesses and new ideas. You know, the role of the entrepreneur in the world is, I think, becoming better understood and the challenges that come with that. But I'm always inspired by people that have started something, right? Taken that leap without any safety net and gone out to change their own lives and change the world around them in some way. I get probably more inspiration out of sort of my own peer group and people at my own age that are going through this same process, and we sort of that strength through adversity that you get knowing that people are going through really tough efforts to create something new and to bring that into the world.
How did you, I guess, ignite your passion in this field or in a data, you know, complex problem field in the beginning when you were younger?
I've always been a huge nerd ever since I was a little kid. So a lot of computer games when I was younger and trying
to... Like what?
So my favorite one during high school was Age of Empires and played that a lot. And a lot of Warcraft way back in the day too. And so that just led to a passion for trying to understand things. You know, my parents will tell these stories about how I used to break a lot of stuff as a kid. I just pulled stuff apart. That was my bad habit. That there was nothing in the house, that particularly technology.
DVD
that I,
player.
Yeah, TV, that I wouldn't touch with a... And then once I learned how to use a screwdriver, it got even worse because I'd just pull things apart. Sometimes they'd come back together, but sometimes not. and so it was trying to understand how things work and how the world works that led to... getting interest in aerospace and engineering. My first degree was aerospace engineering. And that led to a lot of work here in Adelaide with the Defence Science and Technology Group. And you know, the more you learn, the more you want to learn and get involved in exciting, interesting technologies.
I mean, light bulb moment is a bit of a terrible term. Is there any... I mean, looking back, was there any particular moment or thing that you dismantled or thing that you discovered that was like wow, like I'm on. This is the world that I want to be in.
Nothing in particular springs to mind, but I do recall it was probably also travel. My first overseas trip with my family and my parents when I was 11 years old, I got to go to the US and Canada and spend some time sort of like I grew up in the country in a small town of 20,000 people to then go to New York City and to see the world and how that was all like so big and exciting. I wanted to be a part of it. So, and I saw technology as a way to help do that.
At what point in your journey then did you make the decision to go out on your own and start your own thing? I mean, you talk about the adversity of entrepreneurship and starting your own thing. What was that moment for you?
So QBranch was born out of a group of people that have worked together for a long time in the defence and aerospace sector. And so we saw an opportunity together. So as a group of people that had been working for a long time on technologies, we saw that quantum computing was starting to make that transition from research labs and universities and into commercial R&D. And so it was like this thing we couldn't resist. It was just this such an enticing opportunity that we knew we could be a part of, that we had to do it. That meant leaping without the safety net and getting out there.
What's been the hardest part of that process?
We describe it as the roller coaster. So some days you're at the top of the roller coaster and it's the most fun you've ever had, and then other days are incredibly tough trying to find your place in the ecosystem and craft a business that can be sustainable and grow for the long term. And the environment changes so quickly that you need to be very adaptive to that. And so what was our 100% certain plan 18 months ago is now quite different to where we are today. And so riding that wave can be really challenging.
Because, sorry, Monty, but the hard part of being at the front edge of this stuff, and it's the front, you know, probably even the front edge of computing, is in that moment when you're ahead of everyone else, there's so much uncertainty, and it's so easy for people to look back and go, oh, well, of course computers were going to work out. You know, of course Apple was going to boom in hindsight. But when you're the ones at the front, it must involve so much unknown.
Yeah, it can be really scary. And we've spent the last 3 years thinking that we were way too early for this technology, that we'd leapt into this thing well before it was really ready, and that we were going to have to spend a couple of years kind of battening down the hatches and like, you know, let's just survive until it's ready. So you spend 3 years having this sinking feeling in your gut that you've made a mistake by being too early. And then you know, here we are this morning with Microsoft making huge announcements on their quantum computing plans. And had we not done all the work over the past 3 years, we wouldn't be able to react to it in quite the same way that we are today. So
what are the funding opportunities for startups in this space, given that there are still the unknowns and that you mentioned this fear of going too early? And I'm sure that there's other companies who share that feeling. I mean, if there's not the commercial opportunities out there immediately, is there other funding options? How do these companies get funded?
So one of the great things that's happened in Australia over the past 5 years is some changes to the venture capital system here, which has enabled an enormous amount of new venture capital to become available. And I think that there's a renewed interest in startups and entrepreneurship in Australia, and just a lot more capital that's available to get to work and to do interesting things. Also, the technology barriers are much lower than they were 20 years ago, for sure. And so the ability for people to get started, create a prototype, create their first system, whether that's in their garage on the weekends, and then be able to take that to venture capital providers, that marketplace is so much more accessible now than even 5 years ago. Just to highlight some good stuff that's happening here in South Australia, there's the new South Australia Venture Capital Fund. It's about $50 million that's been allocated by the South Australian government. It's being operated by a professional venture capital group called Blue Sky Ventures. And so this is a pool of money that's available to South Australian-based businesses to follow their dreams, to take their idea and to the next level. So to have that available now, I expect there to be a rush on the venture capital scene to create these companies.
What has been the catalyst for this acceleration in funding and progression? I guess, have there been any technological barriers that have been overcome recently that have pushed it forward, or is it just more about resources and focus?
I think it's a combination of things. It's certainly got a lot cheaper to start a business or to start a technology company. The accessibility of services that are in the cloud that you can buy for dollars per hour on your credit card, that's very accessible. You know, the ability to create a website in essentially minutes and get that up and running, that really reduces the barriers to entry for people wanting to start their business. And so being able to work through a creative, iterative cycle to create something small, test it, create something a little bit bigger, test that, create something even bigger, and then show that the potential of whatever your idea is, that cycle is much more accessible to people now. And I think also a recognition that small business and entrepreneurship, that is where innovation comes from. That's where enormous amounts of new value is created in the economy. And so we need to invest in that and create the structures for entrepreneurs to do that work.
It seems that, I guess, Australia and South Australia's move into this high-tech world, part of it seems to be driven by, I guess, the shift in economy away from things like manufacturing and things like that. But how do you see Australia's positioning in these industries, why Australia is perhaps a good fit, and why governments are really kind of trying to be a part of this?
I think Australia's got enormous potential to be one of the leaders in a data-driven economy. Australia's got a lot of strengths and good things going for it, particularly our education system. Australia's universities are world-class institutions that are producing extremely bright people that are very capable. And so we need to make sure that they are supported here, and that even if they do go overseas to the States or UK or wherever, that we continue to engage with them and to ensure that whatever they create has some connection back to Australia and the work that we do here. And I think also for tech built around cities, so things like autonomous driving, Australia is somewhat unique in the world in that we've only got a very small number of very large cities. And so the potential to really inject new technologies into our entire population or the majority of the population very quickly means there's only five sites that you need to roll out this new tech in before you've got almost full penetration into the Australian marketplace. And so I think that that as a test bed before you then take it to China or Japan or Korea or wherever in the world, you know, Australia's got a great sort of starting point to try out new things.
Jumping back to the space stuff, because I'm a little bit fascinated by that, what are some of the cool things that are happening, I guess, in this field?
So there's a couple of really great small businesses that are starting up. So one in particular I'll highlight is a company called Fleet, based here. Incredibly capable group that are building small satellites that will help communicate with the Internet of Things explosion of devices around the world. So if you imagine almost every device is going to be connected in some way, Fleet will help provide the communications infrastructure that provides connectivity for all of that globally. So they're doing some great work here. Out of New Zealand is a company called Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab build all of their hardware in New Zealand and launch from southern New Zealand. And they had their first launch earlier this year. The second launch is coming up soon. They announced just this morning that they've got a number of paying customers that will be like on their launch service out of New Zealand. And so it's an incredible testament to that. You don't need to be a large space superpower to do really interesting things. You can be a country like Australia or New Zealand and be a really active part of that ecosystem.
I think it's almost time for rapid fire.
I'm almost thinking Nuffy corner too. I've still got a heap of Nuffy questions. Yeah.
So this is, you know, it's typical us where we look for the opportunity to ask the silly dumb kind questions. Of fan-based, not very thoughtful questions at all. We call it rapid fire, but it's not really rapid fire. You can answer at your own pace, but it just gives us the opportunity to just ask the silly things that we want to ask.
The smartest person that you think you've met?
Wait.
What a bad question. But I still want to know it.
This is a guy that deals with the world's like smartest people
exactly.
every day.
Exactly. That's why I want to know. And you can't have two. You've got to have one.
You can have – oh, gosh.
And being a precision guy, he's not going to want to get it wrong, whereas I just pick any. I just, this person over here.
I can – so I'm not going to pick one. I'm not going to single out – someone in particular. They'll know who they are if they're listening to this, but one of the things that we do at QBranch is that we support undergraduate final year engineering thesis work. So we select a student at a university and we provide them access to quantum computing technology and a little bit of, you know, corporate support and some review and some guidance and that kind of thing. And so this is a really challenging prospect. You've got a 21-year-old or like engineering student that's got almost zero experience, and we're asking them to jump over a bar that is incredibly high. And we've done this now with four or five undergraduate students, and I am always amazed at how ingenious they are and how intelligent they are. They, without fail, they have exceeded our expectations, got the best mark in their class, immediately gone into industry and started to apply this technology.
Awesome.
As a young person. It's great.
In terms of the smartest person he's met, he's definitely not going to say James Begley and Andrew Montesi. maybe this is a slightly different take on your question, James, but is there a fan moment that you've had? Someone who you really admire, maybe an idol or a hero that you've got to meet and you were just starstruck?
A couple of years ago, we were very fortunate to have the opportunity to spend a little bit of time with Jeff Bezos from Amazon and to talk to him about how he saw the future of compute and where technology was headed. And you know, At the time, I didn't know a lot about Jeff personally and sort of like, I don't know, grew up like Bill Gates was always sort of the guy. And the richest man in the world. And so I got to have a conversation with Jeff Bezos about where this was headed. And then after that, I was like, I've got to read about as much about this guy as I can, and to understand the way that he thinks and where this is headed. And so what we've seen since then is just the explosion of Amazon Web Services, and Jeff was absolutely right about the world. And so I really admire what he's been able to achieve and do in
this
world.
Was he charismatic?
Oh, incredibly. And in some ways, I find a kindred spirit in him, in that he's a huge nerd. He's really interested in space technologies as well. So in addition to Amazon, he started a rocket company called Blue Origin. They're here this week in at the space conference. He's somebody that really understands technology, really values the ingenuity and that drive that we get from wanting to understand how things work.
Sort of science fiction movie that you have loved the most?
It was actually a TV series comedy, which I just loved, called Red Dwarf.
Oh, my stepbrother loved Red Dwarf. I never understood it, but
it was funny as hell. And some of the concepts that they tackled in that TV show for a comedy were just really clever things, like time running backwards and different species that they'd run across. I loved it. I found to be more creative than even like what they did on Star Trek.
Being in a field where so many amazing things are happening all the time, is there anything that still stands out for you that just blows your mind when you see the idea or you see something come to life? And what is it?
You know, the one that just blows my mind, and I can't figure out yet how this actually works, is the gene technology, where they're able to program genes now. Like it's called CRISPR. And being able to write information to and read information from genes and genomics, that boggles my mind. And I'm really excited about where that could lead us as a species. How do we, what can we create with that kind of technology?
Where do you sit with artificial intelligence?
I say bring it on. I think there is so much benefit to be gained through artificial intelligence. One of the things we talk about is that AI really means augmented intelligence, so supporting us, supporting humans, and being able to make us better in some way. And so, one of the examples I like to use is that imagine the doctor working at the hospital. They're doing one of those crazy 18-hour shifts. They're tired. They're stressed. They're at at the end of their shift. There's five alarms going off at once. Wouldn't you want an AI sitting alongside them supporting their decision-making to help them not make mistakes or to catch things or to highlight stuff that they want to look at?
So you've answered that intelligently, but then I go and ask the really nuff question and say, yeah, but like, will they ever become smarter than us? But I guess take that point. I mean, you talk about, emotions and feelings the evolution of artificial intelligence.
I think they'll help us be more creative. I think they'll help us do the human things better and to be more human, which is the creative ingenuity, delightful.
Actually, that's just something it's never occurred to me. What an amazing statement. Allow us to be more human. Because when you think about it, robots and computers generally can take us away from doing the things which are almost robotic. Like I'm thinking about people on a conveyor belt just doing that 9 hours a day. Like that's not human, is it?
Yeah, exactly. It's the things that we can automate are the things that are very robotic, that they are repeated sort of scripted actions over and over, and they're not human things to do. They're not enjoyable. We don't get any sense of purpose from doing that stuff. And so if we can allow the AI and the robot to do that work, it allows us to do the creative stuff, which is a lot more fun.
What's the most frustrating argument against this world that you hear?
I think people get a little too futuristic about the notion that AI could, you know, take over and become sentient and Skynet and that kind of thing. It is so far away and so like, so distant that it's fine for a science fiction movie, but it's got almost no practicality in our lifetime.
My last question is, when do you remove yourself from this intellectual world and be present in just something which is just a bit trashy, whether it's a movie, whether it's music? Like, what's your vice to escape this intelligent world?
I love to snowboard, so if I can get out there on the mountains and disconnect from the world, that's heaven to me.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for being a part of Rooster Radio and lifting, I guess, the intelligence levels for a couple of jocks, asking some dumb questions. But look, you know, good luck with everything and completely admire, I guess, the field that you're working in and the work that you've done. So thanks.
Super fun. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to our interview with Michael Brett. For more information, check out qxbranch.com. We have plenty of interesting interviews in the bank and many more to come, so subscribe to Rooster Radio. And if you like what we're doing, leave us a review in iTunes. And connect with us at roosterradio.biz. We'd love to hear from you.